All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Premiere with DJ Jazz on Penguin Radio. We're on our last show here for the month of October, which means our last horror movie. And for our last horror movie, we're going to be going over Poltergeist, which came out in 1982, which is an American supernatural horror film directed by Tobe Hooper. And Steven Spielberg did also have a large part in the making of the film. He wrote and produced the movie. And he would have probably directed the movie, but he had a clause in a previous contract preventing him from directing any other movies while he was making E.T., the extraterrestrial. So Tobe Hooper was selected based off of his work on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre to direct the film. And the movie Poltergeist is set in a California suburb, and it focuses on a family whose home is invaded by malevolent ghosts, and they abduct the family's youngest daughter. So we're going to go over the plot real quick. And if you haven't seen the movie Poltergeist, I recommend going out and finding it and watching it. It's really good. They do have a remake that came out, I think, in 2013, a couple years ago. And that is actually on HBO right now, if anyone wants to watch the remake. But I do always suggest watching the original before watching the remake. I always think the originals are better. So we're going to be going over the plot of the original one, which came out in 1982. So Stephen Freeling, who is played by Craig T. Nelson, and his wife Diane, who's played by Jo Beth Williams, have a small family and a pretty quiet, normal life in Orange County, California. And they live inside this planned community housing suburb, which is named Cuesta Verde. It's just a suburb that was made super quick by a housing development company, and they're all over Southern California and all over most of, basically all parts of California at this point. So Steven is a successful real estate developer, and his wife looks after their children, Dana, whose name is Dominique Dunn, Robbie, played by Oliver Robbins, and Carol Ann, who's their youngest, played by Heather O'Rourke. And Dana is the oldest, Robbie is the middle, and then Carol Ann is the youngest. So the family is just moved in, and they've begun construction in the backyard for a pool. And shortly thereafter, Carol Ann starts to act a little strangely, like she's talking to a imaginary friend. And the family doesn't really pay it much mind because she's very young. She's only about 3 or 4. So having an imaginary friend isn't too extreme for a kid that age. So at this time, broadcasting on television would end at a predetermined time, and then the TV would just go to static. And so one night, the family forgets to turn off the TV, and so the broadcasting ends and the TV just goes to static. And Carol Ann actually wakes up and goes up to the TV and begins talking to the TV while it's just showing static. Nobody knows because the rest of the family is all asleep, but she's talking to this TV as if someone is there on the other side. So the following night, after the rest of the Freelings have gone to sleep, Carol Ann converses with the TV again. She wakes up and starts talking to the static. And at this point, these random flashes appear on the screen, and then this hand comes out of the screen and kind of floats around the room for a little bit, and then shoots into the wall, which is above the adult Freeling, Stephen and Diane's bed. And when it shoots into this wall, it actually triggers an earthquake. Like, the bed starts shaking and the whole house starts shaking. And once it stops, Diane and Stephen wake up, and it stops shortly after they wake up. And then there's a famous line where their daughter turns around and looks at them and goes, "They're here." And that's become like a very famous line, kind of like "Hasta la vista, baby" in Terminator, and "You're going to need a bigger boat." It's become a famous line in movie history because of that. So after that happens, these bizarre events just start happening in the home. A drinking glass that has milk just spontaneously breaks. It kind of just explodes out of nowhere. Silverware begins to bend. The family dog is barking at the spot on the wall where the hand had actually shot through. They didn't see it, but the dog is barking at it because they're supposed to be dogs and cats, or animals just on a whole, are supposed to have sort of an extra sense where they can kind of feel, supposedly when these spirits are around or have been present, they kind of can sense that because all of their senses are at a higher level. Dogs have a higher sense of smell and hearing, and cats have a higher sense of sight and sound. So the dog is barking at certain parts of the house. Chairs are moving, and there's actually a scene where Diane is pushing the chairs into the table, and she turns around, and then they've been pulled back out, and she thinks one of the kids has done it and is messing with her. And she does that twice. She pushes them back in, and then she goes to ask Carol Ann, what did you mean by TV people when you said that the other night? And she's like, I don't know who they are. And she's like, well, do you know where they come from? And she goes, no. And so she kind of leaves her alone, and she's like, okay. And when she goes to turn around the third time, all the chairs that have been pushed into the table have been stacked on top of the table in like a pyramid. And the amount of time that Diane spends in asking Carol Ann about the TV people is maybe 10 seconds at the most. And then all of a sudden, she just turns around and all these chairs are stacked in a pyramid on top of the dining room table. So it surprises her a bit, and she picks up Carol Ann and gets her out of the room. And so then it actually just cuts to later that night when Steven gets home from work. And he pulls into the driveway, and he's going to grab a garbage can, and Diane comes out and is so excited. She's like, you gotta come here, you gotta see this. And she grabs him and just starts pulling him into the house. And in the movie, Steven actually doesn't end up letting go of the garbage can, and he ends up bringing it with him, and it gets stuck in a doorway, and then he has to drop it and let go of it. So it just shows how fast she's actually dragging him towards the kitchen. She brings him to the kitchen, and she set up like a little runway with tape, and she's saying, you know, when we were younger and we used to say, oh, we'd believe all sorts of crazy things and all that. And he's kind of just nodding his head and saying, yeah, yeah. And she goes, okay, watch this. And she puts a table or a chair down in the taped off area. And after a few seconds, the chair starts to rattle a bit, and then it gets dragged from one end of the kitchen to the other by some unseen force. And she is super excited about it. She actually jumps up and she starts screaming. She's like, oh, can you believe it? Look at that. And then Carol Ann comes out and she's wearing pillows basically, and then a football helmet. And then she sets her down on the little pathway. And then Carol Ann zips across the floor and gets pushed by this unseen force as well. And Steven is really amazed. He goes to walk and check on the chair, and he almost steps in the pathway where they taped it off. And he actually almost falls over trying to make sure he doesn't step inside the tape because he's worried he'll get moved along the ground. So when they realize what's going on, that there's some sort of otherworldly force at work in their home, they're not really worried. They're just more intrigued. Like, wow, why is this going on? Why is it our house? And because the activity at this point really hasn't had anything violent in terms of what's happened. It's just been objects moving. And so they're more wondering why this is going on than we should get out of here or something like that. They're not too worried. And so on one of the following nights, a tree that's actually in the backyard animates it. It kind of comes alive, and it breaks through the upstairs window and grabs Robbie, the middle child, the son, and brings him outside. And so Steven and the rest of the family rush to his rescue to try and save him. And at this point, Carol Ann's closet has actually opened up, and things are starting to kind of fly into the closet like they're being sucked in. And Carol Ann is holding onto her bed frame, and eventually the bed frame just breaks off. And so she gets sucked into her closet and through this portal, basically. And so the Freelings, once they've saved Robbie and the tree's been dealt with, they run inside the house and they actually check the closet first, and she's missing. She's not in the closet. But all of the other furniture and items that were in the room are in the closet. So they start searching the rest of the house, and they can't find her anywhere. And all of a sudden, they hear her voice. And when they start looking for where her voice is coming from, they find out that her voice is actually coming from the television set. And the television set is on a dead channel where it's just switched to static, and they can actually hear her voice through the TV. And she's communicating with them from this other world that she's been sucked into. So at this point, not knowing what else they should do, the family seeks out the help of a team of parapsychologists from UC Irvine, which is nearby. And these parapsychologists are Dr. Lesh, played by Beatrice Strait, Ryan, played by Richard Lawson, and then Marty, played by Martin Casella. And so they go to the Freeling house, and they're telling Steven about certain paranormal activity they've been witness to. And Ryan talks about how he saw a toy car that took an hour to move from one room across the other, but they had significant evidence to say it was probably spirits. And Steven's kind of nodding and going, oh yeah, that's very interesting. And so he's like, oh, this is the bedroom. And so they go and they open the bedroom door, and almost everything in the bedroom is flying around the room, levitating. There's lamps that are floating around the room, not plugged in, and the bulbs are glowing brighter and dimmer. There are books that are flapping around like birds. So it's just a more comical part of the movie that's been woven into the horror aspect, where despite the fact that their daughter is kidnapped, the director had time to put in this little, oh yeah, that's interesting, you saw a car, it took an hour to move, and it was probably ghosts. And then he opens this door, and it's just this mass chaos of all these objects flying around because of these spirits. And so it's a really good movie in that aspect, because that happens a lot in the movie, where there'll be times where you are really worried for the characters, or you're not sure what's going on, or you think something's about to jump out of the corner, and they'll work some comedy in there just to lighten the mood. That's another reason it's such a great film, and I do recommend you watch it. So after investigating the house for some time, the group determines that the Freelings are dealing with a poltergeist, and that the disturbances are because of more than one spirit in the house. So some background on poltergeist. The word itself is German for noisy ghost, and it's a type of ghost or supernatural entity which is usually responsible for physical disturbances, like loud noises, objects being moved or destroyed, and they're also been supposedly capable of pinching, biting, hitting, and tripping people. And most accounts of poltergeist describe the movement or levitation of objects such as furniture and cutlery, and noises such as knocking on doors. So they really cause a lot of havoc, I get, if you do have one in your house. They really try and, it's almost like a gremlin, they really try and mess with almost everything. And they also tend to haunt a particular person rather than a specific location. And they are typically drawn to people of emotional distress, someone that might be depressed or anxious, or extremely angry about something. Someone who is very emotional distressed is supposed to be a big draw for these entities. So, and early accounts of poltergeist date back to the first century. Another interesting note, the Enfield poltergeist case of Britain was actually the subject of the movie Conjuring 2, which came out this past season. During the Christmas time, I believe it came out. So if any of you have seen that, the ghost that was responsible for that movie is actually a poltergeist. So while speaking to his boss, Teague, about missing a lot of work, Stephen, the father, discovers that Cuesta Verde was actually built on what used to be a cemetery. And Teague, his boss, actually tells him that they plan to build a new development on a cemetery plot that they're walking by. And he actually says, you know, oh, wouldn't this be a perfect spot for you and your wife to have a new home? And he's like, oh, we can't do that. It's sacrilegious. And he goes, why not? We've done it before. Where do you think Cuesta Verde was built? And at this point, Steven is just disgusted. And so he really doesn't know how to respond to that. He's just found out that he's been selling all these houses to these couples and these nice people, and their houses have been on a cemetery. So he kind of goes off in anger, and he goes back to the family. So at this point, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with talking about the poltergeist on the premiere with DJ Jazz. This is Penguin Radio. Carry love from town to town. Keep your eyes on the prize. All right, we're back on the premiere talking about the Poltergeist. So when we just left off, Steven had actually discovered that the housing development that they had been living in, that all these paranormal activity had been happening in, has actually been built on a cemetery. So he goes back, and while the team, the parapsychologists, are spending the night gathering data, Marty is frightened by these visions where he goes to the fridge to get some food, and all of a sudden the food just begins to rot. And when he drops the food, all of a sudden there are maggots in the food. And so he runs to the bathroom to kind of clean his mouth out, and he notices a cut on his face. And when he goes to inspect it, his face kind of just begins to fall away. And it's a really crazy scene. It's just basically this clay or rubber and fake blood, and it's this face, and it's just this guy peeling it away down to the skull, basically. And so all of a sudden there are these flashes, and he looks up, and his face is back to normal. And then while they're all asleep in the living room around the TV, hoping to hear Carol Ann, they end up getting this footage of all these spirits walking down the living room stairs, and then they vanish kind of into nowhere. And then they hear Carol Ann's voice, and she's talking about how she's worried that something's following her. And they're trying to get more information, and she ends up sort of running away and running up the stairs. And when she runs up the stairs, Diane, who's standing on the stairs, she kind of passes through her, in a sense. And Diane, she turns around, and her eyes are really wide, and she's like, I felt her. I she was right here. And she grabs her shirt, and she smells it, and she's like, I smell her. Her smell is on my clothes. And she goes up to Steven, and she goes, I'm not kidding. Smell me. And he smells her shirt, and he's like, oh, my God. Because her smell had actually transferred onto her shirt. So at this point, Dr. Lesh leaves so that she can show her findings and then get more help. And she lets the family know that Marty is not coming back just because of his experiences in the house. But she will be back, and that Ryan is going to remain behind and then aid them in any following disturbances. So after Dana, at this point, Dana and Robbie, the two other kids, are sent away just for their safety. And Dr. Lesh and Ryan call in Tangina Behrens, who's played by Zelda Rubinstein. And Tangina Behrens is a spiritual medium. And in the movie, if you see her, she's a interesting looking character just because she's very short. She's maybe 5 foot, maybe even shorter. And she has these very big, very thick lens glasses. And then her voice is very high pitched. She almost sounds like a munchkin. And actually in the movie, Steven makes a joke about the fact that she looks and sounds like a munchkin. When she's walking around the house inspecting it, and she says, you know, I need time to see where the energy is at its worst. And so she's walking around, and Steven looks at Dr. Lesh, and he goes, are we working over the rainbow tonight, doctor? And he kind of laughs to himself because he thinks she looks like a munchkin from Wizard of Oz. But she actually ends up having a lot of insight, and she talks about Carol Ann and what's going on before they even tell her anything about the situation. So they kind of change their minds, and they agree to ask for her help. So Tangina states that the ghosts inhabiting the house are sort of lingering in this sphere of consciousness where it's sort of described as limbo, or what limbo is supposed to be, where when a person dies, if they die tragically or very suddenly, sometimes supposedly their spirit is not sure or not certain of the fact that they're dead. They're not knowledgeable of the fact that they're dead. So they still think they're alive. And so they'll want to stay on Earth when they should have moved on to the next portion of their afterlife, I guess. And so these ghosts are not at rest, and they're attracted to Carol Ann's life force because Carol Ann, despite the fact that she is in this other world, is alive. And so the energy that's coming off of her is different, and these spirits can sense that, and they're attracted to it because they all want life, and they all want what they no longer have. So this is forcing these spirits to be distracted from the real light that's actually come to help them move on to the next life, to wherever they're meant to go. So Tangina also adds that there is a demon known as the Beast who has Carol Ann under restraint because Carol Ann's life force is attracting all these spirits, and it's making all this energy from all these spirits is then making the demon only stronger. So at this point, they discover that the entrance to this other world is actually through Carol Ann's bedroom closet, and they find out that the exit is through the living room ceiling. And they test this in the movie by they take a tennis ball and they throw it through the closet door, and then it comes out through the ceiling, and Ryan actually catches it and he lets him know. So in an attempt to rescue Carol Ann, they throw a rope through this portal and then until it comes out the other side, and then Diane agrees to go through the portal. At first, Tangina, the medium, says she'll do it, but Diane goes, she's more likely to come to me. I'm her mother. I should go. And Tangina goes, you have no idea what's in there. And Diane turns around and goes, well, neither do you. And then Tangina kind of looks at her and she goes, you're right, you should go. And then hands her the rope. So Diane agrees to go through to look for Carol Ann. And so she ties this rope around her and goes through this portal. And then Tangina starts speaking to the spirits, saying, spirits, you should all go to the light. Please go into the light. And at this point, Steven gets confused because when they had talked to Carol Ann earlier, Tangina told Carol Ann to stay away from the light. And this is because the light, quote unquote, the light, is seen as this the portal that's supposed to lead these spirits on to the next life or the next portion of their afterlife. And Carol Ann is alive, so she's not meant to move on to that stage yet. And so Steven is a little confused, and so he starts yelling to Diane. He's like, Diane, get out of there. And he starts pulling them out, and as he starts pulling them out, this huge monstrous face just comes out of the closet. And so Steven has to step back, and he still keeps a hold of the rope, and then this face retreats back into the closet. And through the living room ceiling, Diane and Carol Ann actually drop. And they had actually planned on it ahead of time, so they had placed down pillows and like a mattress. And when they come out, they're unconscious, and they bring them into the bathroom where they had prepared a tub of hot water. And they're completely covered in what's supposed to be ectoplasmic residue, which is this, it's supposed to be a calling sign of when a spirit has touched a physical object. It's like this goop, this kind of thick, this thick kind of fluid that just sticks on stuff. And so they're covered in this, and they put him in a hot bath, and they slowly start to come out of it. And as they become conscious, Tangina looks around and she says, "This house is now clean," kind of to symbolize that the house is free of all the spirits. So after all this that they've been through, they decide that they're going to move. So they begin the process of moving, and they've packed up most of their belongings. And during their last night in the house, Steven leaves to go to his office so he can quit his job. And Dana goes out on a date. So the only people at the house are Diane, Robbie, and Carol Ann. And that night, Robbie is attacked by this clown doll that he has in his bedroom. And Diana hears him, and she goes to help, but then she's forced up the walls and onto the ceiling by this demon or this unforeseen force. And Robbie is fending off this clown doll in his room, and Carol Ann is watching as her closet door is this light's coming from it, and the portal's beginning to open back up again. And so Diane is finally able to escape the bedroom, and she runs towards Carol Ann and Robbie, but this spiritual beast kind of forms on the door, and it's got this really long drawn out face, and the sound effect for it sounds a lot like a lion, and it forces her down the stairs and into the backyard, and she falls into the pit that's where their pool is supposed to be. And when she goes to swim out of it, because it's raining at this point and there's water in there, all these skeletons pop up and they kind of surround her. And so she swims to escape, and all these skeletons are grabbing at her, but she manages to get upstairs. And when she opens the door, there's just this huge portal where the closet used to be. And it's just this, it's this huge light coming out of this portal. And then she's able to get Carol Ann and Robbie to link hands and then grab her, so they're able to get away from the portal. And so they're running through the house and they're trying to get away. And throughout the neighborhood and throughout the house, these caskets are popping up out of the ground and they're opening up, and these skeletons are, and these rotting corpses are just falling out. And it's through their house and it's actually through all over the neighborhood. And so Steven arrives at this point and he sees all this going on, and he runs to go get in the front door, and one blocks off the front door. And Teague actually gave him a ride back to his house. So Teague is looking at all the, his boss, the one who had originally designed and built and planned for the housing development, is looking at all this going on, and he's just really confused. And Steven goes up and confronts him at this point, because Steven realizes that rather than relocating the entire cemetery when they planned the development for Cuesta Verde, Teague only moved the headstones to the graves and then left the bodies buried underneath all the houses and effectively desecrated the burial ground. And so that is what originally caused all these spirits to become so unruly and become unrest, is just because all their bodies and where they had been buried had been desecrated and they had been forgotten about. So Steven leaves Teague and he goes and rescues his family. So the Freelings are actually able to escape, and the rest of the neighborhood watch as the house actually collapses in and folds in on itself into this portal. And then it just disappears. At the light fades, and then there's just the ground where the house used to be on, and the house is gone. And Teague is just left standing there, and he kind of looks down just in shame and in foolishness over having made such a unwise decision. And so the family, who's just really and at this, while all the chaos is going on, a funny, once again, another part where they weave comedy into the horror. While all this is going on and there's all the bodies coming up out of the ground, Dana actually comes back from a date she's been on, and when she's staring at the house looking at all this, she kind of yells like, "What's going on?" But if you look really close in the movie, she's actually got like two or three hickeys on her neck from the guy that dropped her off from her date. So she's freaking out about, you know, the house and all the bodies, but it's, once again, it's just weaving in some comedy where she shows up with these hickeys on her neck she would normally get in trouble for from her parents. So the family, you know, they're all battered and tired, and so they go to a local motel and they check in for the night. And the last shot is they enter the motel room and close the door. And then a few seconds later, you see the door open and Steven wheels out the TV set that was in the motel room and then looks around in the hallway and then closes the door again. And what, there again is a little bit of comedy where he just doesn't want the TV in their room because of what happened at the house. So it's a really good movie, and there's funny parts of it, there's really scary parts of it. It's just a really good all-around movie. And even though Steven Spielberg didn't direct it, he did have a lot to do with it, and you can totally tell just in the way the film was made. So we're going to take another break right now, and then we're going to get into the production aspect of Poltergeist. So this is Penguin Radio. You're listening to DJ Jazz on the Premiere.
220 different species of trees, creating a breathtaking woodsy environment. DU, Did You Know, brought to you by the DJs of Penguin Radio. With you, there's no place I'd rather be. To lose.
All right, we're back here on the premiere talking about Poltergeist. And so we're going to get into the production aspect of the movie. So as I had stated before, there was a clause in Steven Spielberg's contract with Universal Studios, and it prevented him from directing any other film while he was preparing E.T., the extraterrestrial. But Time and Newsweek had actually tagged the summer of 1982 as the Spielberg summer because E.T. and Poltergeist were released a week apart in June of that year. Some began to question Spielberg's role during production, and Spielberg's actually quoted as saying, Toby, who's the director, Toby isn't a take-charge sort of guy. If a question was asked and an answer wasn't immediately forthcoming, I'd jump in and say what we could do. Toby would nod in agreement, and that became the process of collaboration. So it does seem, in part, like Steven Spielberg had a lot to do in the decision-making process, and it really was him making most of the decisions. So the Directors Guild of America opened an investigation into the question of Hooper's official credit of the film. Co-producer Frank Marshall said, "The creative force of the movie was Steven. Toby was the director and was on set every day, but Steven did the design for every storyboard, and he was on the set every day except for 3 days when he was in Hawaii with George Lucas." However, Hooper stated that he did fully half of the storyboards. So there's a lot of conflict in terms of who did what. The Hollywood Reporter printed an open letter from Steven Spielberg to Hooper in the week of the film's release, and the letter was read like this: "Regrettably, some of the press has misunderstood the rather unique creative relationship which you and I shared throughout the making of Poltergeist. I enjoyed your openness in allowing me a wide berth of creative involvement, just as I know you were happy with the freedom you had to direct Poltergeist so wonderfully. Throughout the screenplay, you accepted a vision of this very intense movie from the start, and as director, you delivered the goods. You performed responsibly and professionally throughout, and I wish you great success on your next project." So Steven Spielberg is trying to be civil and trying to right any wrongs he might have done, although he still feels as though he didn't direct this movie. It was Toby's movie to direct, but he did have his own part in making the movie. So several members of the Poltergeist cast and crew of the years consistently stated that Spielberg was sort of the de facto director of the picture, while other actors have claimed that Hooper directed the film. Rubenstein, who played the medium, said that Steven directed all 6 days that she was on set, and Toby set up the shots, and Steven made all the adjustments. Poltergeist was awarded the BAFTA Award for Best Special Visual Effects and was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Visual Effects, losing the award for Spielberg's other summer hit, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. The music for Poltergeist was written by veteran composer Jerry Goldsmith. He wrote several themes for the score, including the lullaby, Carol's Anne theme, and it was supposed to represent this blissful suburban life and then Carol Anne as the young female protagonist. And he also wrote this elegant sort of religious melody for whenever they wanted to show spirits or sort of that the spirits were kind of trying to contact the freelings or some of the people who were alive. And then he also made these dissonant blasts and these roars, these really deep roars for moments of terror when these monsters and these demons would sort of materialize out of the walls. The score went on to garner Goldsmith an Academy Award nomination for Best Score, but he actually lost to fellow composer John Williams for E.T. the Extraterrestrial. And then again, there was more controversy over the film because Poltergeist originally received an R rating from the Motion Picture Association of America. This was because the PG-13 rating didn't really come into effect until 1984, 2 years after the movie had already been released. And it might have been an appropriate rating for the movie, but Steven Spielberg and Toby Hooper disagreed with the R rating, and they managed to have the film changed to a PG rating. So even though it's a pretty scary movie for younger kids to watch, it's still a PG movie today. So when it came out, Poltergeist was released by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer in June 4th of 1982, and it was a commercial success, grossing $76,606,000
$280 in the United States, making it the highest grossing horror film in 1982 and the eighth overall of that year. So the film was well received by critics, and it's considered by many as a classic of the horror genre, as well as one of the best films of 1982. And it's continued to receive recognition over the 30 years after its release. It maintains an 88% certified fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Poltergeist was selected by the New York Times as one of the best 1,000 movies ever made. It was received recognition from the American Film Institute, ranked 84 on their 100 Years, 100 Thrills list. And the line "they're here," which Carol Ann says after the spirits come into the house from the TV, was named 69th greatest movie quote on American Film Institute's 100 Years, 100 Quotes. The film received 3 Academy Award nominations: Best Original Score, Best Sound Effects Editing, and Best Visual Effects, and lost all of them to Spielberg's other film, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. So it's a really interesting scenario, because there's all this controversy over whether Steven Spielberg really did direct Poltergeist or not. And in the end, he has this letter and all this media interview saying that, you know, I did not direct it. It was all Toby. But at the end of the day, Steven Spielberg does still end up winning all the awards for his other movie, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. So even if he did in a large part direct this film Poltergeist, he still ended up winning awards in the long run, which is kind of funny, because it seems like they were trying to do it just so they could kind of drag his name through the mud, and yet he ends up winning these awards anyway. So there's also something along with this film known as the Poltergeist Curse. So the Poltergeist Curse is attached to the movie trilogy and its crew, because there were many different problems, and there were actually 2 deaths from some of the cast members over the 6 years between the release of the first and the third films. And the rumors often fueled by the fact that they used real skeletons in various scenes as props in Poltergeist and Poltergeist 2, The Other Side. They used real skeletons. Dominique Dunn, who played the eldest daughter Dana in the first film, died on November 4th of 1982 at the age of 22, when she was actually attacked by her abusive former boyfriend, John Thomas Sweeney. He was convicted of voluntary manslaughter and then sent to prison. And then the second cast member who actually died ended up being Heather O'Rourke, who played Carol Ann in all 3 of the Poltergeist films. And she passed away in February 1st, 1988 at the age of 12. And she passed away due to complications from an acute bowel obstruction. So it's just very strange that this movie that has such heavy connotations to the supernatural ended in this 2 deaths of these cast members. Another supernatural film that was actually rumored to be cursed was The Exorcist, where they had a set destroyed by a fire, and they had a priest brought in numerous times to bless their sets. They had a harness break during one of the scenes where the demon is throwing around the little girl. A harness broke and actually injured her during the filming, and they weren't sure. They thought she was just acting when she was crying out, like, in pain. And then actor Jack McGowan, that played Burke in The Exorcist, actually died shortly after completing his scenes due to complications with influenza. So these supernatural movies, while they are just movies, sometimes there are some connotations underneath that are really frightening. And you see that a lot with movies that are based off of real events. When you watch a movie that says that before the title, such as The Strangers and Conjuring. And so one of the ones that I think is the most famous, or one of the ones that I guess I personally like the most as well, is The Amityville Horror. And The Amityville Horror is based on a real event. And it's based, the Amityville Horror, the original movie actually, that was made based off of the events that happened, came out in 1979, and it was directed by Stuart Rosenberg, and it was based on a novel of the same name that was written by Jay Anson in 1977. And so the story is based on the supernatural experiences of the Lutz family, who moved into this home on 1112 Ocean Avenue in Amityville, New York. And that's that address. It's that house is still there today. If you look up the address, that house is still there. And a year before, there had been this mass murder committed in the house. And so they moved in, and within 28 days, they had fled the house, leaving all their possessions, all their furniture, all their clothes, all their jewelry, the food in the fridge. They had left everything in 28 days due to the paranormal phenomena that they experienced. So this murder that occurred there, Ronald DeFeo Jr. walked into a bar in Amityville, Henry's Bar in Amityville, and he declared, you got to help me. I think my mother and father are shot. And so DeFeo and a small group of people went to 1112 Ocean Avenue, which was near the bar, and they found that indeed DeFeo's parents were dead. And one of the group made an emergency call to the Suffolk County Police, and they searched the house and found that the six members of the family were all dead in their beds. The victims were Ronald Jr.'s parents, Ronald Sr., who was 44, and Luis, who was 42, and his four siblings, Don, 18, Allison, 13, Mark, 12, and John Matthew, who was 9. And all the victims had been shot with a 35 caliber lever-action rifle, and this had been happened around 3 o'clock in the morning. And the DeFeo parents had both been shot twice, while his siblings had all been hit once. And according to the Suffolk County Police, the victims were all found lying on their stomachs in their bed. So someone had gone room to room and shot them almost execution style while they were lying in their beds. And so an interview at the station that followed actually exposed there were a lot of inconsistencies with DeFeo's retelling of the events of how it happened. And the following day of him being held, he confessed to carrying out the killings himself. And he admitted he had actually taken a bath and redressed and detailed where he had discarded his bloodstained clothes and the rifle cartridges before arriving at work as usual. And his trial began on October 14th of 1975, and him and his defense lawyer, William Weber, mounted a defense of insanity because DeFeo claimed that he heard voices that were telling him to kill his family in self-defense because he felt like they were plotting against him. So it's strange that he's hearing these voices, and he could very well be insane. But who's to say it's not has to do with anything supernatural? So, because with no real sound suppressor on the rifle or no evidence that a suppressor was used, once that first shot was fired, you would think that the family would wake up and be alerted to the gunshots, or at least a neighbor would be alerted to the sound of gunshots. Yet there was no noise complaint or reports of gunshots from any of the neighbors. And there's no sign that any of the family tried to get up and run, you know, no signs of a struggle at the crime scene. The time at which he committed these murders was 3 a.m. And 3 a.m. is mostly seen as the witching hour in terms of the occult, because it's sort of the peak of nighttime. 3 a.m. is sort of like noon, in terms of noon is the middle of the day. 3 a.m. is sort of the peak of nighttime. And it's supposed to be when these dark beings, such as demons and witches and these dark spiritual forces, are supposed to be at their strongest. So after this all happened, the house was empty for about 13 months, so a little over a year. And it was sold to the Lutz family in December of 1975 for what they saw as a bargain price of $80,000. And the house, if you look it up online, it's this really large, old-school colonial house with a large porch, and it's got a boathouse out back that connects to a lake. It's a really nice house if you look at it. So George and Kathy Lutz were married in July of 1975, and they each had their own homes, but they wanted to start fresh with a new property. Kathy had three children from her previous marriage, Daniel, age 9, Christopher, 7, and Melissa, or Missy, who was age 5. They also had a dog named Harry, During their first inspection of the house, the real estate broker actually told them about the murders and asked if this would affect their decision. After discussing the matter, they decided it wasn't a problem. And I don't know about you, but I think the first thing that would make me not want to buy a house is if a mass murder took place in basically every bedroom of the house. But that's just me. So the Lutz family moved in December 19th of 1975. Much of the DeFeo family's furniture was actually still in the house, and it was included for $400 of the deal when they bought the house. After one of their friends actually learned of the history of what had gone on there, they suggested performing a blessing at the home. And so Father Mancuso, that's actually the name that's been given for him. He's never really disclosed his real name. Father Mancuso was a lawyer previously, and he was a judge of the Catholic court and a psychotherapist, and he had lived at the local Sacred Heart Rectory in town. So he came in to bless the house, and when he had flicked holy water and began to pray, he said he heard a very deep masculine voice telling him to get out. And when he was leaving the house, he actually didn't mention the incident to George or Kathy. And on December 24th of 1975, he called George and advised him to stay out of the second floor room where he had heard the voice. And this was the former bedroom of Mark and John DeFeo. And Kathy had planned to use it as a sewing room, but the call was actually cut short by static. So they didn't use the room much, but they still would go in there from time to time. Following his visit to the house, Father Mancuso supposedly developed a high fever and blisters on his hands. So there's a lot of reports, or at least from the family, there's a lot of report of what went on there or the phenomenon that went on there. And there's just a long list. And some of the things that would happen would be George, the father, would wake up at around 3:15 every morning, and he would go out and check the boathouse. He felt like there was someone in the boathouse. And later he would actually learn that this was the estimated time that Ronald DeFeo Jr. woke up and proceeded to kill his family. The house was plagued by swarms of flies despite the winter weather. It was December when they bought the house, and yet there were all these swarms of flies in the house. Kathy would have these vivid nightmares about the murdered DeFeos, and she discovered the order in which they were killed, room to room. The Lutz children also actually began sleeping on their stomachs in the same ways that the DeFeos were found at the murder scene. There were cold spots all throughout the house and odors of perfume or excrement. And if the smell of excrement and there being no sort of real source of it is supposed to be a sign of a demonic presence. And so while they were tending a fire, George and Kathy supposedly saw the image of a demon with half of its head blown out, and it was burned into the soot in the back of the fireplace, sort of like an image ingrained in there. The Lutz's 5-year-old daughter, Missy, developed an imaginary friend that she named Jody. And when she pointed out Jody one night, a vision that they saw of her, it was this demonic pig-like creature, they said, that had this glowing red eyes. George used to wake up to the sound of the front door slamming, and he would race downstairs, and he would find the dog sleeping soundly at the front door. Nobody else would have heard the sound, although he said it was loud enough it should have woken up the whole house. He would hear what he described as a marching band tuning up, or like a clock radio playing on not quite the right frequency, so you can hear sort of two different types of music. And when he went downstairs, the noise would just cut off instantly. George also realized after a couple weeks of living in the house that he started bearing a strong resemblance to Ronald DeFeo Jr. His hair got longer, and he stopped shaving so that his beard grew out in the same manner that Ronald DeFeo Jr.'s looked like. And he started drinking at the Witch's Brew, which was a bar where Ronald DeFeo was actually a regular customer. And he had no information about this before, but he had just decided to start going to this bar, and then he found out afterward that it was a bar that was frequented by Ronald DeFeo. While in bed, Kathy would receive red welts on her chest and was levitated 2 feet into the air by some unforeseen force. Locks, doors, windows in the house would be damaged. Cloven footprints were supposed to be attributed to an enormous pig that appeared in the snow outside January 1st of 1976. Green gelatin-like slime oozed from the walls in the hall and also from the keyhole of the playroom door to the attic. A 12-inch crucifix that hung in the living room by Kathy revolved until it was upside down and then gave off a sour smell like excrement. George tripped over a 4-foot-high China lion ornament in the living room and then found bite marks on one of his ankles after he had tripped. Later, this lion would reappear in the living room after George had moved it back upstairs into the sewing room and then locked the door. So, once again, there's a sign of spiritual activity is these objects moving on their own. George saw Kathy supposedly transform into a woman of the age of 90, and he said she had the hair wild, a shocking face, the face mass of wrinkles and ugly lines, saliva dripping from a toothless mouth. So he says he supposedly saw her transform or age all these years just very rapidly. After deciding that something was wrong with the house that they couldn't explain, George and Kathy Lutz carried out a blessing of their home on their own on January 8th of 1976. George held a silver crucifix while they both recited the Lord's Prayer, and they were in their living room. George said he heard a chorus of voices asking them, "Will you stop?" So by mid-January of 1976, they had another attempt to bless the house by George and Kathy, and they experienced what they said what would be their final night in the house. And the Lutzes then fled the house, just leaving everything behind. And they declined to give a full account as to what happened, saying it was just too frightening for them to have to retell. So on January 14th of 1976, George and Kathy Lutz, with their three children and their dog, left 112 Ocean Avenue. And the next day, a mover came in to get all of their things and move it into storage. And he reported no phenomena at all, but he had spent the entire day there, despite the fact that the Lutzes said that the last night they spent in the house was the worst in terms of all the activity. The mover who came in the next day reported nothing. And so this was a big stepping stone for skeptics to stand on and say, see, you know, nothing's going on here. But there have also been paranormal investigators and psychologists that believe that the reason that this hasn't happened is because when these spirits or these forces sort of exert all this energy in doing all this physical trauma or physical phenomena in the real world, levitating objects, making things disappear, causing bite marks, things like that, it requires a lot of energy and it sort of burns them out. And so once they're burnt out, they sort of need to lay dormant and charge up before they can do something again. So to this day, the house is actually there and people live in it. There's a family that lives in it, and they say they get people that come around to look at the house because it's so famous, but they themselves have reported nothing. So it could be that nothing happened at all. It could be that something did happen and then these spirits are gone. Or it could be that something did happen and then these spirits are just dormant in this house waiting. So if you ever do end up in the Amityville area, 112 Ocean Avenue is actually still there, and you can go by and visit it. And I'm sure the people there wouldn't mind too much if you took a picture or asked them some questions, because they say they get people all the time. But that's going to do it for tonight here on the premiere. Thank you again for listening to Penguin Radio and me, DJ Jazz. I'll see you next time.